Nicholas Thomas is a professor of historical anthropology at the University of Cambridge and director of the Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. He is originally from Australia and the author of numerous books. Nicholas Thomas, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Welcome. It's great to hear from you.
Well, I enjoyed reading your book. Always been fascinated by people who take long voyages anywhere. And certainly, there's probably a lot of unanswered questions about how people made it to the Pacific Islands. Can we start off with just an overview of what we know or what we don't quite know and are trying to understand about that migration?
It's a fascinating and complex story that can go back as far as 60,000 years. In that period, during the Pleistocene age, where sea levels globally were far lower than they are in modern times, people moved from island Southeast Asia to Australia through New Guinea and began to colonize islands off the southeast of New Guinea. And the extraordinary thing about those first journeys, those really early journeys, we're talking about 30,000 years ago or so, is that this is a moment actually where people worldwide seem not to have had boats that we have any record of or any knowledge of, but somehow these people in that part of Melanesia on the huge island of New Guinea made the decision to venture offshore and search for islands that may or may not have been there. And when they undertook those voyages, they began by visiting places like Manus off northern New Guinea. And when they made that voyage, they lost sight of the land behind them before they could see any land ahead of them.
Wow.
And that is really an extraordinary step for humanity, because our species in general has been continental. People moved out of Africa into Asia and Europe, and even the Americas were settled by land across the Bering Strait at a time of lower sea levels when that was a land bridge. So these ventures of people from an expanded Southeast Asia, archaeologists and geographers refer to it as Sahul, a big sort of shelf of land that stuck out across where Malaysia and Indonesia are now.
Mm-hmm.
The people who left that region and started discovering these islands to the east and north of New Guinea were doing something that was unprecedented in the whole history of humanity. But they ventured as far as the northern Solomon Islands, but didn't go a great deal further. And the people who colonized the wider range of the Pacific Islands, as we know them today, Hawaii, Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, New Zealand, and others, came from Formosa, Taiwan, or the adjacent area of that part of China. About 5,000 years ago, they moved down into the Philippines, around the coasts of New Guinea, and then extraordinarily rapidly, in human terms, they expand through island Melanesia, nations and territories like the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, into Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, that area in Western Polynesia. And the thing that is astonishing and basically enigmatic about those voyages of settlement is that that whole series of archipelagos are discovered and settled over the course of a few generations, a couple of hundred years. And we just don't know why people would have embarked on those expeditions and ventured out into vast swathes of open ocean in order to find new land.
It was
this has been
Well, I was just going to ask, it was one of my questions as to why they would do this. I mean, a lot of migrations, I assume, people are looking for food, a better life. They're trying to escape warfare or something. But you're saying that we just don't know?
This is a question that people have speculated about a great deal. And sometimes people said, well, you know, maybe there was a question of population pressure on the island that they were coming from and conflict around land and resources. So in that case, it would, of course, be understandable for people to think, well, maybe we'd have a better chance somewhere else. But the thing that's very striking is that people are clearly arriving somewhere like northern Vanuatu. And there are large islands there with extensive forests and environments of many different kinds, but they're clearly then deciding to sort of move on and make a further major expedition only a couple of generations later. And clearly those islands settled by relatively small groups of people cannot have become overcrowded in that short period. One of the most intriguing suggestions that's been made is, given that these societies were all ranked in terms of the status of elders, people who were descended from the firstborn or the person who'd sort of founded a particular settlement or community were the people of highest status, and you essentially, as a founding ancestor, became a kind of, you know, demigod, and your progeny would be the people of greater status in that community. So there seems to be an aspect of a pursuit of prestige, a pursuit of social status, a will to build a kind of legacy, even sort of posthumous renown, and that aspect of sociality is certainly very fundamental in the Pacific, and rank and status in that sense is still hugely important in societies that maintain those traditions today. Fiji, Samoa, and for example, think of peoples, the way native Hawaiians still cherish the kingdom and the status of the rulers there.
One of the questions, and one of the things that's always fascinated me, is how they navigated using the stars. What do we know about that?
This is really an astonishing dimension of the customary knowledge of the peoples of the Pacific. And we know that people could and did make return voyages between islands that were far, far apart. One of the aspects that fascinates me is that they had a sense on each of their home islands that there were departure points, so that in order to embark on a successful voyage, you had to leave from a specific place. And in many cases, the topographic markers there, like hills or rocks, or in sometimes stones that people had erected and put in place, formed directional markers. So there was an awareness that you couldn't just sort of start from anywhere and then identify your route and followed it. You had to start from a specific point that gave you bearings, and you would leave at a certain time of the day so that by the time those bearings dropped out of sight, your heavenly bearings came into view. And there was a deep knowledge of the stars. There were stars that provided points of orientation at the time that they were rising, and there were other stars that could provide triangulation at later stages as the movement of the night sky progressed. I think it's important to add that it wasn't ever just the stars. These people lived on water from their infancy. They played in water, they subsisted in water, they were fishing people. They knew currents and winds intimately. They would watch the sort of flow of the rollers once they were out in open ocean. All of these kind of elements of the marine environment were signs and wayfinders, even though, yes, the stars were critical. They also had developed arts for recognizing land as they were approaching it, stacks of clouds, birds that would fly in certain directions. There was a very deep knowledge that not everyone in these communities, but master navigators would have, that they would acquire through training, through their youth, before they reached the age where they could successfully direct a longer distance return voyage.
Which brings me to ask about the boats, the rafts that they created. Pretty remarkable. And some of that has been, some of that technology has been lost due to erosion and that sort of thing. Is that correct?
Well, I think one of the aspects of this story that really intrigued European navigators who went to the Pacific in the 17th and 18th century were extraordinarily impressed by the boat building skills of Pacific Islanders, Chamorro in Guam, Tongans in Western Polynesia, Tahitians and others. And they were, I think, particularly astonished by double-ended boats that could change direction without having to reverse. They were impressed by the sails. They were impressed by the outriggers. The structure of the boats was very different to those that Europeans were familiar with, but they could see that they could sail rapidly in open ocean, and also that they were intricately constructed, often having planks that were sewn together internally so that there were no holes that penetrated from the outside of the inside of the boat to the outside. They used coconut fiber, sinnet, which was perceived as a sort of ritually powerful form of fiber binding that connected things and connected people, so it had a sort of spiritual strength as well as a purely physical one. It's really tragic in a way that none of the big boats from places like Tonga from the 18th century are extant in museum collections, but we do have a good idea of how these boats were constructed from some really fine, carefully observed drawings that early draftsmen, people on those voyages of exploration made, and later islanders made models of historic boats, and some of those models are in collections, and those models and the drawings were very important over the last 30, 40 years, as islanders such as Hawaiians have been keenly interested in reviving ancient voyaging and constructing boats that are often not made of the same materials but bear the same naval architecture, if you like, of the historic canoes.
You mentioned the early explorers that went there in the 17th and 18th centuries, future colonizers, I guess. How were the residents of those islands viewed by, I guess, mostly European sailors and colonizers?
Well, this is really interestingly complex, because certainly some of those Europeans brought stereotypic views, the kind of stereotypic views that you might expect, and thought that people who seemed to be warlike were barbaric or savage. But there is another strong thread that runs through this history, which is really about shared knowledge a genuine interest in sharing geographic information. It's particularly conspicuous in Cook's voyages, the voyages of Captain James Cook, particularly to Tahiti, but really throughout many places in the Pacific. He and some of his fellow mariners, scientists and others were interested in local customs and knowledge. They had some competence in local languages, and their interest was reciprocated by people who were effectively the local intellectuals, priests, navigators and others who were themselves equally curious about what these mariners were doing there. And one of the most extraordinary expressions of this mutual interest was a map made by a Society Islander, Tupaya, on Cook's first voyage when the Endeavour was leaving Tahiti to go in search of a great southern continent and eventually make its way back to England. Tupaya was interested in joining Cook's expedition. He travelled with Cook to New Zealand and interacted with Maori there, unfortunately died in near present Jakarta, Batavia, on the voyage home when many became ill with fever. But he produced an extraordinary chart with a huge number of islands on it that reflected his knowledge of the region around the Society Islands. Some of the islands on that map are very easily identified. The identifications of others have been debated by generations of scholars, but even though, in a sense, we'll never quite understand what Tupaya was representing, the thing that is very clear about that map is that it's a sort of expression of a kind of shared research interest and a shared interest in understanding that extraordinary oceanic part of the world.
You wrote in your book about tattoos as a way to sort of link people together. Talk about that. I found that really fascinating.
Well, Cook was astonished as he sailed around Polynesia because he was unprepared for the possibility that you might find people on these islands that were hundreds or thousands of kilometers apart. And he really had no expectation that these people would evidently be closely related. But when he sailed from Tahiti down to New Zealand in 1769, and when on the second voyage he ventured further into eastern Polynesia and went to Rapa Nui, to Easter Island, it was immediately apparent to him that the people had cultural attributes in common. So tattoo was conspicuous right across all those communities. They immediately saw that these people were, you know, in some sense relatively closely related to those they'd encountered far away, and that immediate visual impression was reinforced by language, by obvious affinities between the words for numbers and you and me and simple words of that kind. Mm-hmm. I had a sort of recapitulation of this experience myself when over 20 years ago I had a chance to visit some Aboriginal Formosan people in the highlands in Taiwan. People related, in a sense, descendants of the ancestors of people who settled all those islands right across the Pacific. And I was astonished that they had tattoos that, you know, weren't identical, but had a sort of structure of motifs that was very similar to those of people you might encounter today in Samoa, Tahiti, the Marquesas, Hawaii. Some of these tattoos have been revived over recent decades, but their imagery has deep histories, and it is just incredible that some of those deep histories are still visible in the affinities between motifs of people who are living thousands of kilometers apart.
We're speaking with Nicholas Thomas, professor of historical anthropology at the University of Cambridge. If you'd like to join our discussion this morning, you can do that by phone, 800-838-3760, or you can send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. In some of these early expeditions, I don't know specifically with Cook, but maybe some other ones, you write about how we started to see some of those early scientists, if that's the right term, I guess, joining these expeditions, which I assume were mainly merchant-oriented. Was there any kind of tension on board, or did they work together and respect one another fairly well?
Well, I think you could sort of do a soap opera or a reality TV program around these expeditions, and often, in fact, there was all sorts of conflict. The British expeditions were actually typically naval expeditions, and they were focused on navigational discoveries. Was there a great southern land? How did you map this coastline? And so on. The natural historians were interested in people. They were interested in collecting things, collecting natural specimens, collecting artifacts, artworks that people made. Yeah, there was often tension, and in fact political tension also. On Cook's second voyage, the two scientists were Germans, in fact, resident in London, but they were Enlightenment figures who were in fact politically radical by the standards of the period, and they were immensely concerned about the way other sailors engaged with local people, about incidents of violence, about exploitation, in fact also about sexual commerce involving local women, so that many of the political issues about empire and cross-cultural contact that people are conscious of in the present were actually being debated on these ships at that very moment, often being debated acrimoniously. In some cases, relationships were tense and violent. In other cases, indigenous people were very interested in meeting Europeans and interested in the things they could get from them and in the stories they had to tell.
Was there sort of a uniformity to how these various cultures were structured? People would move from one island to another. Would they pretty much adopt the same lifestyle, the same kind of beliefs, and how they organized their societies? Or was there a difference as people tended to spread out across all those islands?
The Pacific is fascinating because there are affinities right across the ocean, but there are also very striking expressions of diversity, and there are affinities in things that people eat, there are affinities in reverence for ancestors and for rank for the firstborn, for certain kinds of ancestor worship. There are, in a sense, rather specific customs like the use of earth oven, like a pit in the ground to cook ceremonial food on feast occasions, and that's something that you witness all the way from New Guinea to Hawaii and New Zealand. But the diversity is very striking as well. There are places where the societies are quite localized, and where rank and status is really about men and women gaining renown through particular ritual activities like raising pigs that are then presented ceremonially. So there are those smaller scale societies, but in places like Tonga and Hawaii especially, there was really a greater degree of local centralization. You would have local chiefs in particular districts who then recognized the authority of higher chiefs and going right up to the Tui Tonga, the King of Tonga in the case of the Tongan archipelago, and Kalaniopuu and his predecessors and successors in the Hawaiian Islands. So a great deal of diversity in culture and political institutions, but also certain underlying affinities that people could recognize.
Nicholas Thomas, I have a question about also about that distance, about trade and social relationships. Were people going back and forth frequently between these islands to trade different things or to maintain relationships with relatives? It wasn't just a one-way travel, was it?
No, and it's important to make distinctions between these very extended voyages of settlement. We presume, for example, that Rapa Nui, Easter Island, was settled from Tahiti, the Marquesas, ditto. It seems that early on there was a certain amount of back and forth voyaging, but once populations grew in an archipelago like the Marquesas, it seems then that long-distance voyaging gradually lapsed. But people continued to interact extensively within those archipelagos. The situations varied from place to place, but there were typically many voyages that connected islands that were, in a sense, part of an archipelago, part of a sea of islands. People were intermarried, they connected for ceremonial reasons, for periodic ritual, they connected for trade. And some of this was really not trade just to get something, like basalt that people might make adzes from that could only be sourced on a particular island, or volcanic glass or some other product that had a local source. The motivation very often seems to have been social. People traveled in order to initiate relationships, to build relationships, to sustain relationships. And there have been brilliant studies of communities in various parts of the Pacific, going back to a founding figure in anthropology, Bronislaw Malinowski, who studied the Trobriands off southeastern New Guinea. At the start of the 20th century, and his key observation was really that the value of exchange and gift-giving and trade was social. This was really how people gained renown. They created shell valuables, they gave certain valuables in one direction and received other valuables in others. And these expeditions were really the key social and political events for these communities. So one thing that the whole history tells us is that there's always sort of more to economic life than economics. It's about social accomplishment and the capacity to connect and build relationships. That's critical for those societies.
Prior to Christian missionary work, were the islands religiously diverse, or were they more unified in their beliefs?
It's a hard one to answer because at one level there are prominent affinities. The celebration of ancestors is critical everywhere, not just in a sense the expression of reverence for people who are part of your genealogy who came before, but also the tracing of ancestry, particularly because ancestors are the people who give you rights to land, to particular knowledge, to a set of connections, to the capacity to engage in particular sorts of ritual. So that in a way, most of the kinds of things a person, whether male or female, might want or need to do in the present are, in a sense, licensed for them by kin, by ancestors, people who came before. So that that fundamental social basis in belief is critical, really, right across the Pacific. But at another level, there are many different myths and stories. There are different narratives about particular gods. There are distinct rites and forms of sacrifice in many different communities. But I suppose if one was trying to sort of take one general thing out of all that, is that it's that religion is not up there and far away, but intimately part of the family, the kin group, the people, and the environment. You would try to ensure that agriculture, fishing, or voyaging would be effective and successful by propitiating the relevant ancestor gods.
Was there a lot of, I'm assuming probably the 19th, starting in the 19th century, maybe the 18th, I don't know, was there a lot of Christian missionary work in that area, and what kind of impact did that have? Were the islanders receptive to that message?
The Pacific has been changed and impacted by European colonial power in many different ways over the last several hundred years. But the missionary impact, the missionary involvement, is really in some ways the most fundamentally important and enduring part of that story. When missionaries arrived from the end of the 18th century, they were initially unsuccessful. In Tahiti, for example, people were very angry because voyagers had introduced disease, and that had led to a lot of death and malaise and a general decline in health, depopulation, and they associated missionaries as Europeans with that catastrophe. But over time, the mission, the Protestant mission in that case, seemed like a kind of option that was worth trying for some local communities, for some local elites. They were interested in writing, and they could see that writing was a kind of technology of power for Europeans. You could inscribe a message on a piece of paper and send it somewhere far away and get a result. So it was a way of having an effect at a distance. They were fascinated by that. They were fascinated by introduced cloth, and missionaries were often the brokers of that cloth. So about 1815, Polynesians around Tahiti did adopt Christianity. And what is really important about the time after that is that other Pacific Islanders were actually mainly missionized not by the white missionaries from Britain, but by other Polynesians, people who entered the church in Tahiti or Hawaii or Samoa, who then became islander missionaries, who then took their own version of Christianity to other communities and persuaded people to renounce heathenism and destroy images of the old gods and start building churches and in a way reconstruct and reimagine their communities on Christian lines. So it's a process that's kind of hard to understand in some ways. At one level, it's obvious. People abandon a form of local paganism. They take on a new religion. But what we don't really know, especially when you go back to the mid-19th century, is what they really thought they were doing and what their motivations were. But certainly islanders in many of the modern Pacific nations very definitely made their own decision to adopt Christianity. And it's also very clear, I think, to anyone who spends time in the Pacific today that they have made Christianity their own. It is a religion that bears local values and is a way of expressing community identity, local projects and ambitions, and indeed local conflicts, which is why people often split off from one church and join another.
Mm-hmm. Is there a movement today? I think you touched on this, and it seems like I read about this in the book, that there are some islanders who are stepping forward today to preserve their own history and anthropology and archaeology, and to make sure it's told in their voice and not filtered through somebody else. Is that happening today?
Well, I think one of the other aspects of Pacific history that's really fascinating is that we associate that kind of movement, in a sense, cultural self-determination, with the present, but it actually has a very deep history in the Pacific, so that back in the 19th century you find, for example, native Hawaiians founding the Hawaiian Historical Society and writing and publishing records of custom and tradition. And that type of initiative took place around that time in the second half of the 19th century in many parts of the Pacific. You get people who are educated in a Western sense because they've got involved with the church, they're literate, they're community leaders in one sense or another. They're often people who are very committed to documenting customary knowledge and trying to enact it and ensure that it survives. But that said, I think the last 30 or so years has been a distinctive period for that guarding and sustaining and developing of indigenous knowledge to take all sorts of steps forward and be far more visible publicly than it was before. Every so often there are festivals of Pacific arts. I think they started in the 1970s, and they take place in the Cook Islands, in Guam. I think one was due to take place in Hawaii that's been rescheduled because of the pandemic. I've had the privilege and the pleasure of going to a couple in Samoa and Guam myself. But these events are just extraordinary contexts for people to come together and perform and tell stories and exhibit works of art in the sense of made artifacts and physical objects, but also art in the sense of oratory and dance and song and every other genre you can think of. We mentioned tattoo before. So I think there is an extraordinary and very exciting revival of customary practice in many domains, in many parts of the Pacific, despite the sense that islanders in some places are you know, dealing with huge challenges, environmental challenges such as sea level change, which is an existential threat in atoll nations like the Marshall Islands and Kiribati, extraordinary large-scale mining and logging in parts of Melanesia. It's not entirely a rosy picture, and of course the involvement of China in the region is also very challenging for these smaller scale nations. But I guess what really impresses me is the sense that people are determined to shape Pacific futures on their own terms.
Our guest this morning has been Nicholas Thomas, Professor of Historical Anthropology at the University of Cambridge and the Director of the Cambridge Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. His book, Voyagers, The Settlement of the Pacific. Nicholas Thomas, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk.